You are monitoring this channel. The game is up. We've captured your helicopter base along with a Black Hawk. You can hear one of my planes overhead. We own the air now. The courthouse is surrounded. There is no alternative but surrender. Tell your people to drop their weapons and come out with their hands up. All who surrender will be treated by the rules of war and will be exchanged or paroled. That is my one and only offer, Fredericks. I have someone else here who wants to speak to those under your command. He held the mic open and nodded for Deidre to speak. She identified herself, repeated John's offer, and added that what they had been told about the treatment of prisoners was a lie. All had been fed and treated with respect, and the wounded were already back in a hospital.
"What they told us is a lie," she cried. "I know many of you. Please surrender. This is a senseless fight. Please listen to me."
John took the mic back. "Any of you serving under the lying despot, this so-called Administrator Fredericks, put your weapons down now. Come out with hands up, and you will receive parole and exchange and return to your families. You have 1 minute to act. Otherwise, may God have mercy on your souls."
"Sir, can't you just wait?"
It was Deidre.
"Sit it out for a day or so, and I know most will crack. Let me keep talking to those with the ANR. They don't want this fight any more than you do, and will surrender if given a chance."
He wanted to agree with her. He knew taking on troops dug into the courthouse, county office, and county jail would be costly, but time most likely would be on Fredericks's side. If Greenville responded with air assets, they could be here in little more than 30 minutes and everything would unravel. A couple of Apache helicopters circling overhead would switch the odds back to Fredericks's side. If there was any chance of taking him out, it had to be now. He shook his head, hoping her appeal for surrender worked. There was a flurry of shots from within the courthouse, half a dozen running out. One dropped to the pavement, shot in the back from within the courthouse. John clicked the mic back. "All units, hold fire! Hold fire! Let them surrender!" The half dozen did not make it far. A burst of automatic fire from an upper floor of the federal building slaughtering them. There was more fire from the county jail, flashes of gunfire from within. A door burst open and two more ran out. They were dropped as well.
"Those were friends of mine," Deidre cried. "His security team is killing them."
"Damn you, Fredericks," John shouted. "For God's sake, show some mercy." Several more tried for a run from the county office. All died within seconds. "It's on your soul, Fredericks," John cried. "All those who stand with you." He had one flare left. He raised the pistol over his head and fired it off. A fusillade of fire erupted seconds later from the 300-plus troops deployed around the courthouse. He now wanted to keep his losses at a minimum. It was simply a question of overawing or, if need be, waiting them out unless he received word that Greenville was sending choppers up. He prayed that resistance would collapse before then, that there would be no need for a frontal assault or charge and resulting slaughter out of some Civil War battle or amphibious beachfront attack. Overawe in the first minutes, break the will of the jittery ANR troops inside. With the captured armaments from the helicopter base, there was a surfeit of ammunition for once. A 50-caliber machine gun moved up by a team of Afghan vets to a position on the roof of the BB&T building poured an arcing stream of heavy fire down on the three main buildings of the courthouse complex, incendiary rounds igniting fires in the upper floors of the courthouse. He held back the 24 air-to-ground rockets designed for the Apaches, because no one was sure of how to properly mount and shoot them, but half a dozen of the town's homemade RPGs were fired, several going off wildly, but two striking the county offices, igniting yet another fire in an upper floor. In an amazingly lucky strike, one hit the Bradley, the crew within abandoning the vehicle and running for the security of the courthouse, though there did not appear to be any real damage to the vehicle. After the initial rain of fire, in an attempt to overawe, the situation settled down to near silence, and carefully aimed shots by trained snipers on John's side. If Deidre's ridiculous stereotype of mountain rednecks had one true point, it was that John had in his ranks dozens of highly skilled hunters armed with deer rifles and high-powered scopes, and it was doubtful that his opponent had the same. The morning dragged on, heat increasing, John looking at his watch ever more anxious. his radio man catching several quick appeals from someone other than Fredericks to Greenville calling for air support. John could feel the pressure building. Greenville to Asheville was indeed within air support range for Apaches. From liftoff to attack, they could be on him in little more than 20 minutes. Billy had returned twice to Black Mountain to refuel, and John sent an order for him to climb up to at least 8,000 feet, move south to over Hendersonville, and report in if any kind of air support or ground movement up from South Carolina was approaching. They were 4 hours into the siege. In his mind, he felt he could, if need be, let it drag out for days, since Greenville had not yet taken any action. But if they did, the tide could turn in a matter of minutes, and this chance to end the madness would be lost. The top 2 floors of the county office were completely ablaze, black smoke billowing straight up in the hot, still noonday air. In the county office building adjoining the courthouse, numerous smaller fires were burning on nearly every floor. The sight of it sickened John in a way. Everyone who lived in the region knew the legend of how, during the Second World War, the local hero, Bob Morgan, pilot of the Memphis Belle, one of the first B-17 bombers to complete 25 missions against the Germans, had flown his plane between the 2 buildings in an ultimate buzz job. His grave was at the Veterans Cemetery in Black Mountain, where those who died fighting the Posse rested. Before his death, Morgan was a regular guest visitor to John's class. John connected those memories to this tragic moment where the buildings now housed an enemy and those dragooned into serving him and what he allegedly represented. "White flag!" one of his team cried. John raised his binoculars, focused on the county building, and there was indeed a white sheet or towel hanging out of a window, a floor above where the fires raged. Someone was standing in the window, waving, making the gesture of throwing his weapon out to clatter on the pavement below. Smoke began to billow out of the room he was in so that he climbed out onto the window ledge. The sight sickened John. It was, of course, a gut-wrenching reminder burned into the heart of every American, the memory of the morning of 9/11. The man tried to crawl along the ledge, and John felt a swelling of pride in his troops in that no one fired at the man, and several around John were whispering encouragement. And then he lost his balance, tottered, and fell, plunging 12 stories to his death, and John heard groans of anguish erupting around him. He turned back to his radio man and took the mic. "For God's sake, Fredericks, your people are burning alive on the upper floors. Get them the hell out. We will not shoot." He paused a few seconds, clicking the mic 5 times to signal it was a message to all units. "All units, all units, cease fire unless directly fired upon. Let them surrender. Let them surrender." Apparently, there was more than one radio link between the 3 buildings under siege monitoring his own broadcasts. Within seconds, 12 more white flags were out from upper floors. Someone in the prison building had managed to find enough bedding. After shattering a window, someone tossed a rope ladder of sheets out the window and started rappelling down the side, reaching the pavement 6 floors down and holding the rope ladder taut as a woman in black uniform came out next. But before she had dropped a floor, shots rang out from the county courthouse, and she plunged to her death. The man on the ground ducked low and ran hard, dropping as puffs of shattered concrete erupted around him, but then he was up again, reaching a low stone wall and tumbling over it. "Send someone down there and try to find that man and bring him to me," John shouted, and one of his security team got up, crouched low, and sprinted off. Apparently, at least 1 sniper in the upper floor of the federal building was still alert and nearly hit his runner, triggering another explosion of return fire that plastered the side of the building for several minutes. "Deidre, you got the guts to get closer?" John asked. She looked over at him and nodded.
"Yes, sir."
He motioned to his radio man. "Ready for a little running?"
"John, I'd prefer not, but I'm game if you are."
"Damn it, John," Lee snapped. "You can control things just fine from here."
John looked at his old friend and smiled. "Okay, everyone, take a deep breath."
He hesitated. The order was indeed so hackneyed in so many bad movies.
"Follow me."
He got up, crouched low, and started to sprint down the tunnel road, zigzagging every few seconds, startled a bit when he heard a bullet slap by close to his face. It was a long 200-yard run down to the base of the hill, every gasp for air an absolute agony.
until he finally dodged into cover behind a building at the northwest corner of the traffic circle below the courthouse complex. He looked back. One of his team was down, clutching his leg below the knee, a medic dragging him to cover, shots kicking up around them. He did not need to call for suppressive fire. Several hundred rounds slammed into the three buildings, any window that still had a pane of glass shattering. Whoever had fired on him and wounded one of his team was either dead or cowering. "Deidre, you can talk your people out better than I can. You've seen how we've behaved since taking you prisoner. Do you trust me?" She looked at him and nodded. "Try to talk them out and end this before any more people get hurt. I promise you, I will move anyone with the ANR who surrenders to arrange their repatriation back to their homes as quickly as possible." At this point, as to the fate of Fredericks and others, he was making no promises after more than 4 hours of this day's madness and the weeks leading up to it. Deidre took the megaphone and began to appeal to those within the courthouse complex to surrender and end the killing. Her appeal was heartfelt at times, that she was in tears, begging those within to just give up and come out with hands up. Then she made a gesture John had not anticipated, and it happened so quickly he did not have time to react. Deidre suddenly stepped out into the middle of the traffic circle, megaphone still raised. "Please, all of you, surrender. I promise you, you'll be treated fairly. It was those who brought us here who lied." A single shot clipped her shoulder, spinning her around and dropping her in the middle of the traffic circle. John, horrified, sprinted to where she lay writhing in pain and scooped an arm around her, pulling her up as he started to drag her back. One of his security team leaped out, weapon raised to cover the two, and he toppled over backward, shot in the forehead. Lee reached out, grabbing the two, dragging them the last few feet back into cover, the brick from the corner of the building peppering them with fragments. Lee grabbed the radio mic. "Leader, okay, now tear the bastards apart," he cried. John cradled Deidre as a medic came up to their side, crouching low. The medic, carrying a standard pack looted from the stockpile in Sears, cut Deidre's shirt open. She had been punctured just below the left collarbone, and contrary to all movies, a shoulder wound was not merely a nick with the bundle of blood vessels, nerves, and bones just above the ribcage and heart. The medic slapped on a sterile compress, pumped a morphine vial looted from medical supplies found in the Sears building into the young woman's upper arm, stuck the empty syringe to her collar to indicate the dose she had received, and called for stretcher-bearers to take her to the rear.
"Sorry, sir," Deidre said, looking up at John. "Thought if they saw me, they'd lay down their arms."
"It's okay, Captain," he gasped, a wave of pain hitting him from his fractured rib. "You are one hell of a brave woman, even if you are foolish." He looked back out to the street where the young soldier of his security detail was dead, blood pooling onto the pavement. Yet another kid from one of his classes. It wasn't Deidre's fault. It was war with all its stupidity and random violence that had killed the young man. Stretcher-bearers came up and lifted Deidre to carry her off. "When all this is over," John said, "I hope you stay on with us. We need soldiers like you." She forced a weak smile of thanks.
"Nothing to go home to now, anyhow. Thank you."
The next 10 minutes were an explosion of unrelenting fire poured into the courthouses, and he sat silently, staring at the young man lying dead in the middle of the traffic circle, a decent lad caught up in madness who had died trying to do the right thing. And chances were that so many down in the courthouse complex believed they were fighting for the right thing as well, but they had to be defeated now if his community had any hope of survival. Finally, after the long, sustained barrage, white flags began to appear in windows in all three buildings, but he let the fusillade continue on. It was time to break them entirely. "Tell all units to cease fire," John finally announced. His radio operator looked over at him. "Billy reports he thinks he sees at least 3 helicopters coming up from Greenville. Scan the frequencies, see if you can find the one they're operating on, most likely one of the aviation ones, perhaps the standard 122.9 of uncontrolled airspace." As the gunfire slacked off, with only an occasional return shot from the county building where it looked like part of the roof had collapsed in, John edged to the corner of his concealment and held the megaphone up, clicking it on. "This is John Matherson of Black Mountain and commander of the forces engaged against you. I am giving all of you 5 minutes to surrender and come out with hands up. This is my final offer. If you do not comply immediately, we will storm the buildings and no prisoners will be taken. You have 5 minutes to surrender unconditionally, but with the promise that you will be treated by the Geneva Accords. Otherwise, you damn well better be ready to die for that scum leader of yours. In less than a minute, a side door of the county prison burst open, the first few stepping out looking about nervously, and then breaking into a run down the street, staying close to the north wall of the building. From the office building next to the courthouse, it was the same, several score pouring out from a south-facing door, out of view of the county building. From the county building, the fugitives dashed out the side door facing Tunnel Road. Several ran from the main entry, and again, a flurry of shots from inside the building dropped some, but the majority were now making it to safety. Return fire tore into the front entry even as those pouring out of the other buildings raced across the potentially fatal open ground. The first of them reached John's position, having no idea who he was. They were wide-eyed and terrified, begging for mercy. He would rather spare them than kill them, but after all that had happened, he gazed at them with disgust and shouted for someone to take charge of the prisoners and get them to the rear. After 10 minutes, no one else emerged. His radio operator announced that someone inside the building was desperately calling for air support from Greenville, the choppers going into a holding position just south of Hendersonville, which was only a few minutes away by air. It was a moment where Maury, back in Asheville, knew what to do, starting up with spoof radio traffic on the same frequency, announcing he and his assets were up and waiting to take out any approaching aircraft, the frequency jammed up with signals that John prayed was buying them time. It was a risk John could not tolerate. Fredericks would spin out his account of the disaster in the manner all such stories were spun, going back thousands of years, and though John doubted the government Fredericks represented would be willing to drop a neutron bomb on them, two or three fuel-air explosives could nevertheless destroy his beloved valley and all whom he held dear. It had to end now. All units, at my signal, once those surrendering are clear, suppressive fire for 2 minutes, assault units to go in and secure the buildings. He half-stepped out from the safety of where he had set up his command post. A dozen or so black uniforms were running for their lives, a few shots coming only from the county office. On my mark. Now! There was another explosion of fire, all of it focused in on the county office, and there was a fury to it now, a release of rage by his troops, fed up with all that had transpired, and knowing that the cause of it was at last pinned down to this one final corner of trapped bastards. The assault teams started to dash in, crouching low under the suppressive fire, those racing for the federal office and county jail not showing too much concern as they burst into the buildings, but the county office was a different story. A heavy weapon, concealed and silent throughout the fight, now opened up from the third floor, dropping half a dozen of the team heading for the front entry. The way one of them was running, John, like any father, could recognize it was his daughter. A girl running next to her crumpled over, but his daughter pressed on. He watched, heart racing as she disappeared from his sight, his view of her blocked by the building. John could not contain himself. He stood up and started for the side entrance, his security team cursing him soundly, shouting for him to stay back as they sprinted ahead with younger legs and stronger hearts. None of them were hit, but out at the front of the courthouse where his daughter was looked bad. The assault team dived for cover and scattered. Even as John's team reached the side entryway where, across the years, those waiting for their cases, from traffic tickets to divorces to civil suits and criminal charges, had stood wreathed in cigarette smoke, waiting for the courthouse to open. It was a tawdry place in John's mind, having stood out there himself when he had decided years earlier to fight an unfair traffic stop from an overeager trooper on Route 70 who claimed he was 2 miles per hour over the speed limit. His angry comment to the judge that the trooper was just looking to make her quota for the month had lost him his case, but it was worth it for being able to at least say exactly how he felt about things. And now he was running for that door as if his life depended on it, which it most certainly did. The glass door was shattered, his team leader diving through it and coming up with weapon raised, sending a burst of fire down the corridor to cover the others storming in. John lagged far behind, cursing the day he had taken up his first cigarette. The long-abandoned and defunct metal detector that guarded the entryway was still there, his team pushing past it, heading for the stairs that led up to the main floor. The foyer had been built in a grand old style, soaring up 3 stories, ringed with balconies along the 4 walls leading to offices on upper floors, and the foyer was thus a death trap. There were several explosions. Someone was dropping grenades from above. One of his team dropped and was being dragged back to cover.
"Damn it, when will they ever give up?" John thought, boiling with rage.
His people were pouring in enough suppressive fire to disrupt the defense against the main entryway facing downtown Asheville, several dozen charging in, creeping upstairs one at a time, firing toward the balconies and dropping several of the defenders, and then suddenly the firing slackened, several weapons being thrown over railings to clatter onto the floor of the foyer, black-clad troops crying that they were surrendering, holding up their hands and nervously coming down from the upper floors. Nearly all with him held fire, though one of his troopers, filled with rage, nearly reignited the fight when she shot one of the surrendering foes in the head as she turned the final bend of the staircase. She was jumped on and dragged back as she screamed at those surrendering that they were all murderers. John did not react, but knew he'd have to deal with it later. Shots erupted from the corner office suite that John knew was the nerve center and where Fredericks, he hoped, was most likely dug in. Sandbags had been piled around the entryway. The gunner guarding the approach collapsed and dead.
"Fredericks, it's over with. Your people have surrendered," John shouted. "You got 30 seconds to come out, or we blow the rest of this apart and leave you to burn to death because this building is coming down in flames once we pull back."
A broken door ever so slowly cracked open, and to John's utter disbelief, the man was looking out at him, wearing his ubiquitous jacket and tie, as if ready to head off for a noonday power lunch meeting.
"Matheson, you could have written your own ticket and I was ready to write it for you."
"Just come out slowly, you bastard. Hands up."
"For what? A trial by you and then a hanging?"
John would not admit here that was precisely his intent after the crimes that Fredericks had committed, the hundreds who were dead because of him.
"John, I was only following orders. And I suspect you do hate those 5 words, I was only following orders."
"You're damn right I do," John shouted in reply.
"Were you only following orders in Iraq? Were your minions only following orders when you executed the leaders and followers of the posse?"
He did not reply.
"Greenville's air assault team will be here any minute, and if you kill me, John, the word will come down from Bluemont to Neutron or Fuel Air, your precious hick village."
It was precisely what John feared, and Fredericks had hit a nerve.
"Ah, I sense hesitation," Fredericks taunted back. "So what's it going to be, John? We talk this out like 2 reasonable men, or your community ceases to exist. You'd better call it now. The clock is ticking down."
"Damn, he is good," John thought,
as good as so many he had witnessed long ago, stalking the halls of power, amoral sociopaths drawn to power who, behind the smiles and handshakes and backslapping, held men and women of moral convictions and a soul-stirring love of a concept of the Republic in contempt. He knew far too many like Fredericks who, while mouthing platitudes, actually held everyone in secret disdain, because they, as leaders, knew what was best for the people. John took several steps forward.
"It's over, Fredericks, and no, I will not trade you back. You will stand trial in front of the people you ordered murdered, where a jury of 12 of your peers shall decide your fate."
"You mean you don't have the guts to just order me hung now, as you did that posse leader?"
"I hold you in contempt lower than that sick bastard I hung," John replied. "He was driven by hunger and a twisted belief in his Satan that he worshipped. You, you son of a bitch, were driven by something far deeper and darker. You are beneath contempt."
John stepped closer, pistol in his hand, half raised.
"Hands up, Fredericks, and step out slowly."
Fredericks lowered his head, and his voice began to choke up.
"Okay, John, I quit. But no, if you kill me, you've lost your best bet to negotiate your way out of things with Bluemont. I'm worth a hell of a lot more to you alive than dead."
John sighed and nodded.
The bastard was right.
Someone arrest him and get him out of here, and clear the wounded before his damn place collapses on all of us.
He turned his back and began to walk away, disgusted with the entire end of this affair. His rage of minutes before had cooled. Fredericks would live, and chances were, trial or not, he'd be a bargaining chip with Bluemont in the end to spare further retaliation, and then another Fredericks would eventually arrive, for vermin like him certainly did breed like lice and had been a plague since the first day that someone had figured out that while some labored, others would administer.
"Down, John!" He barely had time to turn back when a flurry of shots echoed, stitching Fredericks across his chest. He staggered backward and collapsed into his sacred office. "What the hell?" John cried. "Bastard was drawing a gun on ye,"
someone said, even as the sound of gunfire echoed in the foyer. John saw his old antagonist, Ernie Franklin, stepping out of the gathering that had come into the foyer to witness this final confrontation.
"What?" "He drew a pimp gun and was about to blow your brains out, you damn fool. You're a damn fool, Matherson, turning your back like that, so I covered your ass."
John looked about in confusion. No one spoke. There were faint grins from several as Ernie walked across the foyer, stepped over the sandbag emplacement, and leaned over Fredericks's body. Ernie's hands were out of view for a few seconds as he appeared to pat down Fredericks, and then stood back up holding a small pistol.
"Pimp gun? Bastard like this couldn't even carry a real gun."
He then turned his weapon on Fredericks and put one more round into his head. Without further comment, he turned and walked out of the foyer, pausing to toss the pimp gun on the floor by John's feet.
"Historian, know ye history. Sic semper tyrannis."
Chapter 17, Day 750. John had called for the meeting in the Fellowship Hall of Gaither Chapel at 10 o'clock p.m. for a reason. His trusted team was now augmented by Forrest and also by Ernie, who had simply just bowled his way onto the town council, like it or not. It was something John did not really object to, given that he had essentially done the same thing immediately after the day. Kevin Malady was with them, as was Lee, his arm in a sling from a bullet taken in the final assault. There were also representatives from Swannanoa, a couple of police officers invited from Asheville who, word was, represented a good grasp of public opinion in the survivors of that town. One of the two, the cops John had befriended long before in the first days after the war had started. There was even a doctor from Mission Hospital, which, once the fight was over and it was no longer under Fredericks's thumb, had thrown its support into caring for the injured and wounded. Only a little over 5,000 civilians were still alive in Asheville proper, and John had won most of them over with a most simple gesture. The ANR troops had over 100,000 rations stockpiled, and John decided they would be divided evenly between his community and Asheville. The following day, after the storming of the courthouse complex, a delegation had come to Black Mountain seeking John out with the request that, during the current crisis and until things were straightened out, he and the citizens of Black Mountain would consider a consolidation. It was a decision he could not just make on his own. Ever since the day, there had been a deep sense of division between Asheville and Black Mountain, fueled by the leadership there in the beginning, brought together somewhat when the army was in direct control and then driven wide open again by Fredericks. As to the old pre-army leadership, which had stayed on but faded into the back while the army occupied the town, only to reemerge after the military left and then fallen in with Fredericks, the last of it was gone. Several had died in the battle for the courthouse, and the others, so typically, had excused themselves before the fighting even broke out and tried to flee to Greenville. There were rumors that a Reaver group that at times had control of the two main roads leading out of the southern mountains down to the Piedmont of South Carolina had captured the group. No one was discussing the treatment quickly meted out to them. Both the town council and a vote by paper ballot of the community had been overwhelming to end the standoff, the more pragmatic and savvy politically noting that if they did not try to merge now and offer enough rations to stuff everyone for a couple of weeks in the immediate wake of the shocking battle fought downtown, some new bloc would try to rise up. The strain of it was that the spring planting and acres of fields now under the plow,
along with the birthing of pigs and cattle and the hatching of chickens, promised that come fall, for the first time since the start of it all, there would actually be not only enough food properly stored away to see all through the winter, but even a surplus. The edge of starvation up until this current crisis seemed finally to be pushed back, but the overnight doubling of mouths to feed would again mean living on the edge. The alternative, though, could be infinitely worse, and the situation out in the rest of the world had helped seal the deal up as well. The argument to work toward a new union carried additional weight after the conversation that occurred with, of all people, a reporter with the BBC. The radio on the captured Black Hawk could be spun through a number of frequencies, and earlier in the day, Maury had been conversing with the chopper pilots down in Greenville, trying to talk them down from any follow-up action when, of all things, someone else had chimed in, identifying himself as a BBC reporter based in Canada who had been monitoring their conversation. Murray had fetched John, and it had turned into a regular interview with John presenting his side of what had occurred. The signal was sketchy, wavering in and out, but John had at least been able to get a few questions answered. "Bluemont declares itself to be the legitimate government of the United States," the reporter had replied. "But as for my country seeing it thus, I can't speak to that. England is still hanging on, just barely. We were not hit by the EMP directly. That was focused more on Central and Eastern Europe. The power vacuum afterward has triggered fighting between Russia, on one side, Poland, Germany. We're trying to stand clear. Neither side has stepped to nukes. My government pledged its arsenal to Germany if Russia should go nuclear, and it is tense, damn tense, in your government's decision to pop that neutron bomb over Chicago has the Chinese ready to push the button. I don't know who you really are, John Matheson," the reporter concluded, "though there have been rumors of folks like you trying to re-establish order in spite of what is claimed to be the central government. But I can tell you this, either you take Bluemont out, or they will take you out, and in the process, perhaps re-trigger a nuclear war that will burn off the rest of this insane world." After that, they had lost the signal, and his words had rested heavily on John's heart. If true, this was no longer about the survival of his town and the Reavers from the other side of the mountain and the frightened survivors in Asheville. It was far broader, and he dreaded the sense of responsibility it now carried. It was just about 10, and John nodded to his radio man to switch on his best radio, a small generator outside the room powering up to supply juice. The dial was already set, but it took a slight fiddling to bring the broadcast in clearly with the always soul-stirring ringing of Big Ben and then the always well-modulated voice of the announcer. "This is BBC News. It is 3 o'clock a.m. Greenwich wartime, and here is the news, first from overseas. Today, the Federal Administration of the United States in Bluemont announced a deepening crisis, declaring that 12 more administrative districts have descended into what is defined as Class 5 status. Here is a listing of those districts in alphabetical order. Asheville in the Carolinas, Administrative District 11, where it was announced that the director of that district and his entire team of ANR troops were murdered by terrorists, many of the prisoners being summarily executed. Bismarck in the Dakotas." The broadcast was drowned out by the cries of protest erupting in the room. John stood silent, gazing out the window. Ernie had brought him the report of the broadcast 2 hours earlier. Apparently, the radio set in his enclave just below Ridgecrest had picked up the first of the early evening broadcasts. It really came as no surprise, though he had hoped that his conversation earlier in the day with the BBC reporter had somehow been relayed back to England. It undoubtedly had been, but at this stage, they would most certainly not claim it as fact. All of the radio gear Fredericks and his troops had been using in the courthouse had been lost in the fire, minutes after the fighting was finished. The fire of the upper floors had so weakened the roof that the entire building started to cave in. It had cut John off from any means of reaching Bluemont to try to negotiate, or at least report in as to what had really happened with the tin pot dictator whose body had been left behind to be consumed in the flames. John motioned for order, and the crowd settled down in the room. He had taught many a class in this same room when a larger area was needed for special events that drew larger crowds. The acoustics were terrible, and without a mic and speakers, it could be tough to be heard at times. The radio was still on. "In Syracuse, New York, Administrative District 3, where there are reports of a rebellion and the murders by terrorists of over 80 troops of the ANR. The administration repeated its announcement again today that the draft for the million-troop mobilization for the ANR is moving forward smoothly in most areas, cooperation with the draft being a factor in defining a district as not in rebellion, but it cautioned that those not in compliance will face the full authority of the law, and appealed for those districts not yet reporting in to do so immediately. There has been no response of just how many administrative districts are in compliance so far. In a surprise move, the administration also announced that it is rescinding, for the moment, the authorization to theater commanders of the ANR to use neutron bomb weapons within the continental United States, except when receiving a direct order and released by the administration. The repeated queries by our embassy in Bluemont to respond to the rumor that the acting president was either forced to resign yesterday or has been removed from office have not yet been answered. Again, there was an eruption of comments. That news had exploded around the world early in the day. It was one of the reasons everyone listened to the shortwave edition of the BBC. Few now trusted the Voice of America for anything other than a highly censored version of the news. The implications were profound. Had the administration that sent people like Fredericks out into the field collapsed? Was there a coup d'etat taking place in Bluemont? If true, were they sliding into civil war, or could one hope that more reasonable heads were prevailing and the announcement of the pullback on the use of neutron bombs was a signal of serious change? John kept his ear to the radio speaker, but there was no more news on that front, though there was an announcement of a discussion to ensue with various experts as to what might be transpiring in America. The crowd settled down so that the radio could be heard again. And for our friends in Hong Kong, the sun is rising in the west. I repeat, the sun is rising in the west. And now to our discussion about events transpiring in America today. John nodded for the radio to be turned off. I wanted everyone here, John announced, representing the town council of Black Mountain, Montreat, and Swannanoa, along with our friends from Asheville and representatives from the group some called the Mount Mitchell Reavers, to gather together in one place, garner what news we can from the outside, and decide if we will henceforth move forward in mutual accord. This could go on for some time, perhaps most of the night. I guess I'm stuck with moderating, and I will ask that those representing different perspectives try to limit themselves to 5 minutes. Let's work toward points of mutual agreement rather than tear each other apart. We have a rare chance here to settle issues that have divided us for far too long. Let's bury them here and now. He looked around the room. There is one issue I have to present to you first before we move on to other business, and I am afraid I'll have to hold the floor for this one. All knew what he was about to raise and fell silent. It is impossible at the moment to raise Bluemont. The communications gear to do so was destroyed in the fight at the courthouse. It was undoubtedly on a secured scrambler, so we are in the dark there. I have tried to reach out to Greenville by radio, so far without success other than conversations between Maury and the chopper pilots. At least from that, those pilots know our situation, and Maury feels they just might disobey orders if directed to attack us. They have made no aggressive moves toward us yet. I pray it stays that way. If we cannot raise them within the next few days, I'm asking our friends who live north of Mount Mitchell to head down toward Highlands, talk with the folks there, and see if they'll honor letting a convoy with a team to visit Greenville to pass safely. Also, that will open up a conversation with folks in the southern mountains to consider joining in with us. There were nods of approval to that. What do you think Greenville will do? Someone in the back of the room asked. I can't say for sure. We do know that when the fight was on in Asheville, they did send several attack choppers up, but they stopped while over Hendersonville and the Asheville airport, one of the pilots repeatedly asking for a decision as to whether to go in or not. They turned back about when their signal to the courthouse was lost. We do have the radio in the captured Black Hawk. Maury Heard has raised one of their pilots several times, told him what happened here and why, and made it clear we had no desire to see any more Apaches up here, and we'll react accordingly. I listened in and felt that the pilot Maury was talking to was of the same accord and less than happy with the prospect of turning his weapons, as he said, on our own people. So I want to believe there are second thoughts down there, perhaps even at least an administrator we can deal with in a friendly fashion.
Why not just fly someone down there in the Black Hawk or L-3 to negotiate a truce with them? Someone asked.
I'll not risk such precious assets outside our own territory for now, John replied, and there were again nods of agreement. Once we get the roads secured, I've asked Ernie Franklin to be the one to head the team going down. That did draw some comments, not all of them happy, but more than a few were laughing. John smiled and held his hand up for silence. We want straightforward, no-nonsense talk. Ernie is the man to deliver it straight from the shoulder. Do any of you disagree? Many turned to look at Ernie, who smiled and then finally replied, You're just trying to get me the hell away from these meetings. Maybe so, John replied, and there was a round of laughter and then applause. So that is the situation with Greenville and Bluemont. Are we in general accord to try to reach out to Greenville and ensure no aggressive action will be taken against us? His question was greeted with approval. But until we have a clear answer, at least from Greenville, the military is to stay on full alert, dispersal of population and assets against air attack to stay in place. You all know the mobilization alarms. If you hear them, act immediately. He sighed. And let's pray the war is over. So with that said, I open the floor for comments. For a man who hated meetings, this one, illuminated by candlelight, had something of a different feel. The illumination, the rather sacred nature of the room, actually called Fellowship Hall, triggered the historian in him. Perhaps it was a touch of the romantic in looking at it in such a way. But he could not help it as person after person stood to speak, appealing for a joining together, to set aside past differences, and even expressing the optimism of expanding their reach to all the mountain communities of western North Carolina. By midnight, there was a near consensus to have a charter drawn up for the various representatives to sign, and for the moment, John would be tasked as an emergency commander, but any actions regarding life or limb of a citizen or relations with communities outside their own would be referred to a council made up of representatives from each of the communities. The establishment of an actual elected government was then brought up, and it was decided that this time they would indeed take a census of all those over 18, identifications would be issued, and in 1 month's time elections would be held for all posts. Some were so exhausted at this point that there was a call to close the meeting, but for once John refused such a request, feeling there were still some details to be hammered out and that now was the moment to do it, when a wave of near-idealism filled the room. He suggested that those who needed a break could go into the chapel and stretch out in one of the pews. John, taking a break himself, went into that special place and looked up at the starlight, the sight of the scorched beams and part of the roof missing, reminding him of photos of churches and cathedrals in war-ravaged Europe of many years earlier. Michaela came out to join him, taking his hand, again recalling the first time they had met here. The room was silent. There was no one at the piano at this hour of the morning, and besides, the piano was gone, crushed under a collapsing beam. A heartbreaking sight for both of them, though someone had pulled a scorched flag out of the rubble and pinned it to the far wall.
They're already talking about this fall election with enthusiasm and hope.
He looked at her and smiled.
Maybe there'll be a painting some day, like the one of the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
You are sounding more like a historian every day, Michaela.
Kind of rubs off after a while. Besides, it is what I want for our child.
Elizabeth and little Ben. I do pray that they see it. I was scared to death when I caught a glimpse of her in that final assault wave. I'm so damn proud of her. But now that this moment is over with, I just wish she would go back to being a mother for a while.
I do, too, especially when Ben has a brother or sister to play with, though technically I guess it'll be his aunt or uncle.
It took a moment for that to sink in, and then he turned to her in surprise.
Yep, we're pregnant.
It was all she could get out before he pulled her in tightly, hugging her fiercely.
If she's a girl,
Michaela whispered, and she started to cry.
Can I have your permission to name her Jennifer?
And now both of them cried together. Epilogue, Day 775. Well, here it goes. The expectant crowd fell silent. Paul and Becca Hawkins stood in the open doorway of the rough-hewn power plant, Becca with a hand on the main switch, snapping it down. An instant explosion of light enveloped the crowd of nearly 6,500 who stood around the building and had spilled over onto Montreat Road and the parking lot of Anderson Hall. a long line of festive Christmas lights, strung from the power station to a telephone pole and down to Anderson, sparkled to life. And then there were shouts from farther up the hill, lights in the chapel humming back to life after more than 2 years of darkness. A phone in the power plant rang. Becca picked it up, chatted for a moment, and then looked to John, smiling.
"It's for you, sir."
Though badly shot up in the fighting, parts of the switchboard had been salvaged, and with that as a template, several old phone company technicians had actually begun to assemble an entire new board based in the new town hall in an abandoned daycare center a block away. Only a dozen connections were back in place, but it was a highly symbolic start in John's eyes. They were not scavenging items from the past, retro equipment of 100 years ago, but were beginning to build things from scratch. Psychologically, John saw it as a major step forward for the entire community. He took the phone from Becca, putting a hand over one ear.
"John, we've got electricity up here. How long will it stay on?"
John looked at Becca and repeated the question to her, having to shout to be heard. Becca looked at the old-style analog gauges, measuring the energy output coming from the full-size turbine that was humming away beneath their feet, the generator in the next room whining at a high pitch. The air was redolent with the scent of ozone, and the way it was all rigged up, it did have a bit of a Frankenstein's laboratory feel to it.
"I think it's holding together okay. We're shutting things down at midnight to go over all the equipment. After that, if it is holding together, we'll throw the power back on for an hour 3 times a day, then on full time come evening to midnight."
There were so many factors at play, John realized. Though running smoothly at the moment, this was their first truly operational generator, though work had already begun on a second, and work crews were already busy rebuilding the original power dam for Montreat a couple of miles higher up along Flat Creek. For the moment, this was their one and only power source with no reserve yet in place, and it was not to be stressed. Turning it on at hour-long intervals and then off for 4 throughout the day would allow the hospital to chill down the freezers and refrigerators, his communications teams to recharge batteries, and luxury of luxury, to run a hot water heater at the college and hospital and then washing machines. Hand scrubbing had just become a thing of the past, though the decidedly old-fashioned ritual of hanging out clothing on clotheslines would continue for a long time to come before they had become so profligate with electricity to actually run dryers. The power supply for right now was wired to just the campus and assembly inn, the town council for the time being forbidding anyone to try to tap into the power line for home use. With the second station going in above the first, plans were already afoot to put in a third unit in a cove above Black Mountain, actually over in Ridgecrest, where there had been a power station over 100 years earlier, again a dam that had to be rebuilt. Once in place, that would provide electricity straight into the town. Paul calculated it would provide enough energy to be wired into one of the town's old water pumps. Homes below 2,400 feet in altitude were still receiving a trickle of water from the gravity-fed pond, but it had to be boiled, and 2 years of no maintenance on the lines meant that nearly all the precious water was now hemorrhaging out. With the town water pump back online, 20,000 gallons a day could be pumped up to the old water tank that overlooked the village, and then gravity-fed back down and run through the small filtration plant. That, in turn, meant that they were going to have to find or make new filters and some way of getting chlorine or some other purifier. But what a blessing. That most simple of luxuries would again become commonplace, and with it, hopefully, eliminating E. coli and other illnesses that still plagued the town at times, caused by the lack of public sanitation. So the complexity of it all would then start to multiply. Water going out meant bringing sewerage filtration back online, setting up some kind of public hot showers and laundry facilities, and then...
"John, you still with me?"
It was Michaela on the other end of the phone. "Oh, yeah. Becca said they'll run to midnight. Can you come down for a few minutes? Something of a celebration kicking up."
"Be right down, and I'm bringing someone with me."
She hung up. It was indeed turning into something of a celebration. The students had rigged up a small stage with a CD player and speakers. One of the kids, who again for this moment appeared to be just a college kid, was up on the stage shouting for requests, then held up his hands in acknowledgment and rifled through a stack of old CDs, but he first turned on the player and ran the volume up, and the crowd fell silent for a moment. It was God Bless America, and within seconds all had joined in, more than a few with tears streaming down their faces. He saw Michaela approaching him through the crowd with Doc Wiederman by her side, carrying his medical bag. He tried not to blanch at the sight of the dentist.
"Yeah, John, let's get it done. It'll only take a minute."
John gulped and then nodded in submission to fate. It was time to get the tooth out. "Give me a minute, okay?"
"Yeah, but no escaping this time."
He smiled, nodding to where Lee Robinson, arm in a sling, was standing behind him, ready to snag John if he tried to slip away. Then he felt a reassuring hand slip into his. It was Michaela, and she was in tears, standing silent, looking up at the lights and listening to the chorus singing.
"We got to get you fixed up proper, John,"
she whispered, drawing in close to his side. They stood in silence, listening as the chorus sang the last refrain of the song, and then the party started, dancing beneath the brilliant array of lights, the cares of what tomorrow would bring, or what John had to face in a few minutes, forgotten.
"We're still America. We'll always be America,"
Michaela whispered, drawing in closer by his side. This concludes the reading of One Year After by William R. Forstchen. Copyright 2015 by William R. Forstchen. This book was read by Bronson Pinchot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Spectrum Literary Agency and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.